And our next presentation is by Dr. Cook, and it's antibiotic resistance genes in soils from a cattle feedlot, a 3-year study.
I think it's good to be here and talk to you a little bit about the work that we're doing in a small backgrounding operation in Kentucky. So Lisa's talked some about antibiotics in agriculture. I'm guessing most of you are here because you have an idea that there's a lot of antibiotics used in agriculture for disease prevention and growth promotion. Some of the issues are really the fact that a large portion of those antibiotics pass through unmetabolized or unaltered. And so they enter through, as Lisa said, the manures or waste materials, residual antibiotics, the antibiotic resistance genes, and the bacteria enter in the environment through the animal waste. And, you know, plenty of data has shown that antibiotic concentrations are higher in livestock production areas. This is the feedlot transect that we were working with in our initial studies that we did, looking at soil nutrients and microbial populations. We found that they were elevated, particularly in like the congregation areas, the dirt feeder areas, and then nearby grasses. But then there was pasture grazing area, and they were well filtered out. Dr. Cliff Rice, who is a chemist with ARS in Beltsville, looked at pharmaceutical compounds. So two ionophores and a parasiticide. And basically he found that also in the feeder area there were residual antibiotics or pharmaceutical compounds remaining in kind of between, I think, 5 and 20 times higher. And this is the predictive map that kind of shows where those, this is Meninsen, and it shows where the concentrations were higher and, again, how they were filtered out through the pasture area. So basically the reason people are talking about antibiotic resistance a lot right now, the president just came out with a proclamation to form an organization to address the issues. And so this is a worldwide and international problem that's being focused on because of the number of antibiotic resistance infections that are occurring. Now, they're looking at, and Lisa did a great job of showing, you know, even within agriculture, the diverse path that it can enter into what people care about, which is the human population. And these international organizations, WHO, OIE, CDC, FDA, they're looking at diverse areas. So it seems like we're focusing on ag, but the reason we're focusing on ag is because it's an area that's been pointed out in need of more research to evaluate how antibiotic resistance populations emerge and spread in ag systems. So we need to be doing the research to find out what's going on, carefully, as Lisa says. And so the things that we were interested in is how are the populations distributed across this feedlot transect. We knew there were higher pharmaceuticals in the feeder. How are the populations distributed? How long did they stay in the system? This was actually the feedlot area was destocked after the first year. And then are there differences in different types of genes? So this is a small beef, it's a backgrounding operation, so weaned calves are brought in, they're fed intensively, they're fattened, and then they're sold to the feedlot. And in this area, it was 100 to 120 calves, there were 6 batches per year, and this operated for 6 years, and then they destocked. So this is the barn or feeder area, this is the dirt area here. Again, the pasture, and then a retention basin at the bottom, and these guys are hanging out at the retention basin, and it's on a 4% downhill slope. And they were fed preventative and curative antibiotics. So the approach that we took was to take samples. Dr. Anesley Nathan-Siggy is at Western Kentucky University. He's a soil scientist. Did by far responsible for all of the hard work. I was less worthless than holding a bag for the sampling. But he took the samples and did the mapping, and he's still taking samples now, but we started in 2010 when the animals were on the site, and then these samples are from 2011 and 2012 after the livestock were removed. And because of our previous findings, we just focused on the feeder, the nearby grass, and then some of the grass area where we had seen that the concentrations were pretty much at background levels, because there are high background. And so we took 13 dirt and 13 grass samples, and then I did the molecular analysis to target. These are three different groups of antibiotics that are commonly used in agriculture: the sulfonamides, tetracycline, and erythromycin. With TET and ERM, we looked at a couple of different genes. And these resistances for all of these are, you know, just basically they keep the antibiotic from being as effective, so they're ribosomal or enzyme-protective proteins. So Lisa kind of pointed out that you need to really define what you're looking at here, and I think this is a good example of how that happens. This is erythromycin two genes, B and F, and these are the different sample sites just for the dirt area, log cell numbers, and ERMF is in blue, ERMB in red, and you can see sometimes they're dead on, and sometimes there's quite a lot of difference. Same way with the tetracycline resistance genes, sometimes they're dead on, sometimes there's quite a lot of difference. So that just suggests, one, different locations may have different populations, and two, these targets weren't necessarily the same thing. And we, because of the way we conducted the study, we really can't say what those are, but it's just important to be aware that there can be quite significant differences. Also, because of the graphs I'm going to show later, I thought maybe it got lost that, again, this is sample sites and log concentrations, and it's important to point out sulfonamide resistance, for example, is extremely high. In almost every sample, I do poultry, swine, and dairy, and almost always sulfonamide resistance, I mean, gets close to total cell number, so very high. Tetracycline is kind of intermediate, and then our erythromycin is usually fairly low. And, you know, when we start getting down to these levels, again, background's pretty high already. So there, you know, sometimes it's hard to be able to say a lot about what's going on, but there are definitely significant differences in different kinds of resistance. So these are the predictive maps that Anesley put together from the qPCR data that I did. And this is a 2010, this is sulfonamides, this horrible green that I chose. This shows you where the feeder area is, and then kind of starting here, this is the grassy area. So you can see the intermediate area, 10 to the 9th, so very high cell antibiotic-resistant genes concentrations in the feeder area, and then decreasing with downslope, actually. In 2011, so this is the first year that the animals were taken off of the site, and so we were pretty surprised to find, I guess, you know, some of these really high concentrations dropped out in the feeder, but there was actually an increase in where we, you know, in the downslope areas. And then by 2012, it kind of had rebounded and even improved from the 2010 level. So that's sulfonamides. Tetracycline, so grass, this is basically background, high in the feeder area again, and then some downslope grassy areas. And then again in 2011, we had, you know, surprisingly higher concentrations, and then we actually had reductions that we would have expected from 2 years of destocking. Again, erythromycin, which the levels are generally lower for us anyway. Feeder high, then higher concentrations all the way through the grass, and then by the end, kind of what you would expect to go to background levels. So we saw this repeatedly. I was kind of trying to I've just done preliminary. You didn't see that. But I was just trying to do, you know, trying to figure out, like, where these came from, where the what this could be correlated with. Enterococci are known to have erythromycin resistance. And if this works for me, you can see that there's kind of similar trends in the erythromycin and the enterococci. But the erythromycin is higher than total enterococci levels, suggesting that there's different some different populations involved, and we haven't really looked at that yet. Then Dr. Nathan Singhi had worked on, he does the nutrient work, and I really thought that this 2011 thing must have something to do with some kind of increases in nutrients for some reason. But in reality, in 2011, when they destocked, they also did a manure scraping. And so he had the greatest decrease in nutrients after that manure scraping. So that wasn't really correlated with what we saw in terms of increases in 2011. But then we looked at the two months prior to each of the samplings and saw that there was a significant difference in the amount of precipitation. So obviously there's some effect either, and you know, I really can't say what it is, if it was runoff or it was increased accessibility, because when your samples are wet, you do your core samples, you might be able to get a better sample, and or the bugs can be growing because they have better access. So anyway, those are all interesting questions. I'm not sure exactly what was behind that. So anyway, in conclusion, the populations are concentrated in that congregation area. There's orders of magnitude decreases with destocking, but there's still background populations, but there's always background populations. So you really do need to do a good job of saying this is something that is something we need to deal with because there were animals on the site, or is this just something that's there anyway? And also, this doesn't answer a lot about how this correlates with what happens in the human population, which is also very important, obviously. The long-term response is that there are decreases, but precipitation really did seem to cause some differences in how populations could be detected, and but definitely differences in different types of antibiotic resistance genes. And I would like to acknowledge, like I said, Dr. Nathan Senge is responsible for a huge amount of this work, and Becky Gilfellin at Western Kentucky University, Dr. Cliff Rice, who's done our pharmaceutical analysis, and Rohan Parekh is my technician, without which there would be no data. So thank you, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
We do have time for questions. Any idea of what the depth profiles look like?
No, we didn't. We took 15-centimeter samples. And we didn't, and that would be especially interesting in the feeder area. But to be honest, kind of to start out with, I didn't have a lot of hope because when they did the scraping, they also put gravel down, and so it was a very, kind of difficult place to sample in that feeder area. Otherwise, if I'd seen like cleared out, I'd be like, we got to see what's happening on down. But and it is karst, and so some of that change that we saw with the water or with the precipitation may have to be with some channeling of some kind. It would be interesting to look at.
Any questions? Did I understand correctly that after 2 years that the abundance of these genes went down to background?
Well, in the nearby grass levels they had. So basically, what we kept seeing is the feeder areas probably expectedly very, very high, and then these nearby grass areas really went to basically the same as like if I were to take a sample in the middle of the pasture. So yes, in those areas, but yeah, probably that really the dirt feeder areas, and we still have samples. So we've got 2 more years of samples that I can look at and see if, especially in that feeder area, that they're getting back to normal levels.
Thank you very much.